here are the questions in the box. Ah, there's not so many today. What's this one here? This dummy is for anyone who is fed up. Don't suppress it, don't depress it, spit the dummy instead. Buddhism is for dummies. Adam, is anything wrong with spitting the dummy? That spitting the dummy means when you're really upset and you just let it fly. In other words, you get so caught up inside, you just allow it to explode. But all that does is just allow you to explode the next time and the next time and the next time, and soon you're going to spit the dummy at someone who's bigger than you, and they're going to sort of give you a lot of trouble. So instead of spitting the dummy, we contemplate the dummy. And you know who the dummy is. You, for getting angry. So, don't let anybody control your happiness. You are in charge of your mind, aren't you? So someone calls you a pig, someone calls you a dog, someone calls you idiot, the most stupid meditator ever to sit in Jhana Grove, the craziest, stupidest monk, don't get upset or angry. In other words, just say, I'm sorry, but you're wrong. So that way, you never get angry no matter what people say. What was that story I was telling recently? That there was Greek philosophy. There was this one teacher in ancient Greece. And whenever he would scold one of his disciples, it was like teaching them. So the person who was scolded had to pay an extra dollar for being scolded, because that took extra effort from the teacher, more work. So if I scold any of you Anagarikas, you have to give me a dollar. So that's how he got taught. And after a while, he graduated, and then he went to Athens. And then because he was acting a bit foolishly, sometimes people would scold him. But every time someone would scold him, called him an idiot, called him a pig, he just burst out laughing. And the worse they scolded him, the more he laughed. And they said, how come you laugh when people scold you? Other people get upset when you scold me. He said, look, when I was a student, I had to pay for this. Now I get it for free. That's why I'm laughing. So I like that story. So, let people make you angry. That way you don't need the dummy. Number two, what does rise with gusto stand for? That was in the program, which no one keeps anyway. But rise with gusto means when you wake up in the morning, you've got a choice. You can wake up with energy. Gusto means energy. Just as soon as you wake up, hooray, another day on retreat. What a wonderful opportunity this is. Hopefully Banker told you that, hopefully you help pay for this place and give a donation afterwards. This place costs a lot of money. So get your money's worth. An extra hour in bed is 1 hour off your time enjoying retreat. When you go to work, you can sleep as much as you like at work. But while you're here, enjoy it. So it's like you're on holiday. When you're on holiday, wow, I'm on holiday. I've worked so hard to get here. Now I'm here. You wake up in the morning, yeah, another day on retreat. Wow, another day when I don't have to do anything. Great. How can you waste that time sleeping? You wake up in the morning, wow, whoopee, this is great. I'm in a monastery. I'm in Jhana Grove. Wonderful time. Woo, I don't want to sleep through this. And those of you who want to catch up on your sleep, wait till you're dead. You can catch up in your coffin. You can sleep as much as you like at that time. So that's why when you do wake up, put energy in. If you jump out of bed, wow, whoopee, another day at the retreat. Jump out of bed first and then look at the clock. Blimey, 3 o'clock in the morning, what have I done? But if you look at the clock first, another half an hour, another hour. And that type of mind, it gets you depressed. I don't want to get up. I don't want to meditate. I don't want to do anything. And you know that people who spend a lot of time horizontal, they sleep too much. Because they're horizontal for much of their life, it means in their next life they get reborn as horizontal beings. You know, slugs and snakes and things which crawl around the ground because they're used to being horizontal. That's what they sort of, you know, they feel comfortable with. So be very careful, be upright. And then you'll have to get an upright birth. So that's what it is. You've got to get up in the morning, and it really works. You really get up in the morning, you put energy into that first moment, you wake up, and you get that energy for the rest of the day. You know, because the beginnings are really important. You get it right at the beginning when you wake up. Yeah, sippity-doo-dah, another lovely day at Jhana Grove. But don't shout that, otherwise your people sitting sleeping next door to you, they really get upset and they start complaining to me. You've got this stupid girl in my room next door. She gets up at 3 o'clock in the morning, goes, sippity-doo-dah, what a wonderful way. Yeah, another day. Oh, she drives me crazy. So please do that quietly, but rise up with gusto. That's what it means. How can I relate to a middle-aged relative sister who pretends to be loving, caring, but always has an undercurrent of resentment or ill will? It doesn't matter what she gives you, it's what you give her. That's the most important. Look, if I really concern myself about, you know, what response I do to all this teaching which I've been given all these years. I've been teaching meditation for years and years. And I said yesterday, I've been teaching some of you, I don't know, for 10, 20, 30 years. And what do you give me back? Still the same old problems. So, if it depended upon what I get back, you know, from teaching, I'd have given up years ago. But this particular person, even though she gives you back resentment or ill, well, that doesn't matter at all. It doesn't matter what she gives you. It's what you give her. So keep giving her loving kindness. Wear her down. That's what sort of Margaret Thatcher, you know, one of her favorite sayings was, some cabinet ministers you beat down, others you wear down, and the rest you grind down. So grind your sister down with loving kindness. After a while, she just give in. Tell me about dying the Buddhist way. Dying the Buddhist way is just stop breathing. It doesn't die, nothing to do with Buddhists. I mean, you're Christians, Muslims, atheists, they all die the same. They just stop. Is it best to leave the dying person dead person while the spirit leaves it for several days? What do I write in my living will? I already told you my living will. I'm going in that little... You can see the yellow boxes at the front gate over there. That's where I'm going in when I die. They haven't been taken away yet, but they'll be taken away. When is the rubbish collection coming? Tomorrow morning. So if any of you die tonight, that's where you go. That's the Buddhist way, in the yellow bins to be collected tomorrow morning. Really cheap. You know, we just write to your family, say you're dead and you're in the recycling bin somewhere. Because, you know, save your relations will be probably very happy. Save a lot of money, a lot of messing around with. But if you like, I'll do a bit of chanting over the yellow bin just to make sure that you're happy. So when you're dead, you're dead. So the idea of the spirit, there's no such thing as the spirit, but it's the thing, the stream of consciousness. Stream of consciousness. It's a very good metaphor the Buddha used, because you look at any stream. Yes, it looks the same from day to day, but you know that every moment the water's flowing through. There's not the same water there today that it was yesterday. Not even 5 minutes ago, the water flows. So that's what you are. You're not always the same. It's anatta. You're a stream. And every moment is totally different. But it's a stream of consciousness. So the stream of consciousness, when a person dies, then they leave. This was the great research done by Professor Pim Van Lommel, which I keep asking people to look at. What he found out from his research was the stream of consciousness leaves when a person is brain dead. In other words, when the brain stops working, then that's when you leave the body. So, when you're brain dead, and some of you are brain dead when you're sort of meditating, so you're probably leaving your body. No, you're not. But that's when you leave the body. So when a person dies, they're dead. And it's usually the doctors say, oh, they're gone. So then you can do whatever you like to that body. You can take the organs out if you wish. I'm an organ donor. I carry my card. I haven't got it with me today. It's in my room over there. So I live by example. If I drop dead, before you put me in the yellow bin, take out all the organs you want, and then you can put the rest in the bin. So, I'm an organ donor. Buddhists should be organ donors. And I know that some people say, oh, what if you give your eyes? When you go to heaven, you'll be blind. No, you're not blind when you go to heaven. You get four eyes. No matter how many eyes you give, you get double that back in return. So if you give your heart, you get two hearts. You get a liver, you get six. I don't know how many you get. But certainly, you never lose when you do charity, when you do generosity. So you can give your organs, whatever happens. So when you're dead, you're dead. So you don't have to leave it for several days. You don't have to leave it for hours and hours and hours. Now that actually came from the Tibetan tradition. And that came from, I forget which it was, the works of Vasubandha or Asanga, which is about 1,200 years after the time of the Buddha. That myth about having to keep the body still was a myth which you can actually see historically came a long time after the Buddha. You look at the original teachings of Buddhism and you can see those original teachings of Buddhism. There's no teachings like that at all. When a person is dead, they're dead. You just dispose of the body in the best way. Another other myth, they say those sky funerals in Tibet, where you put your body out and it's eaten by the birds. That wasn't just Tibet. They used to do that in Thailand as well. In particular, the monastery where I ordained in Wat Saket. That's just outside, it was outside the city. The city walls were just next, you can still see some of those old city walls if you know what you're looking for, they're still there. That Wat Saket, the Golden Mount Temple, that was actually the cremation ground for most of the people in Bangkok at the time. And they would, there's a photo of the guy who would, the sepulcher, he would put the body out. And all the vultures would be waiting, and they'd have the sky funeral. That was Thai tradition as well, not just Tibetan. So I think we should go back to the old Thai tradition in Bangkok, instead of having all these expensive funerals, which last for days and cost a lot of money. So anyway, and that was done almost immediately. So they didn't wait for 3 or 4 or 5 days. So they just did it immediately, as soon as you're dead. That's what happened. So four Buddhists. As soon as a person's dead, you do whatever's necessary. You don't have to wait. And I know there was this myth going around. First of all, I heard it in Malaysia, in Singapore as well. They had this myth when a person is dying, you get the monks or the nuns around to do the chanting. And just when they die, you feel whether the head is hot or the feet are hot. Because if the feet are the last part which is hot, that means they leave their body through their feet, the bottom, which means they go to a lower realm, like a hell realm. That's bad luck. But if the head is the last part, which is hot before they die, then they go to the top of the head, which means they go to heaven or some really good rebirth. And so all these monks were doing the chanting, and even though they knew their mother or their father. The father was a scallywag with a mistress here and a mistress there. You know what people are like in Malaysia or Singapore, Chinese people. But not all of them, but quite a few, to be honest. So they knew they had his mistresses, they were scallywags. And they did this chanting, and they really chanted hard. And the head was the last part which was hot. And the relations were so happy. I don't know how you did this. This was a miracle. I know he didn't deserve to go up to heaven, but his head was hot last of all. And they gave these huge donations to the monks. As you would, because your parents should have gone down the lower realms and he goes to the high realms. Because the monks chanting and they make a fortune out of that. If there's any doctor or anyone knows anything about biology, you know that just before you die, all the blood goes to the brain. The feet aren't important. Who cares if you lose your feet, but your brain goes and you're in big trouble. So it's the nature of the body. Just before you die, all of the blood goes to your brain. It's the emergency response. And so all the time, for everybody, whether you're Pol Pot, Osama bin Laden, or whoever you think there's a really bad guy, or bad girl as well. Your head will always be the warm part, which is last of all. So all those monks making money out of sort of myths like that, you're the worst person in the world, your head will be the warm of the last. So don't buy into that. There's far too much superstition in this world, and sometimes people make money out of stupid, gullible people. So don't be stupid, don't be gullible. So our Buddhist dies, we just get rid of the body as easy as possible. And don't go around burning all these paper houses. All it does is make smoke. Smoke doesn't go to heaven. Look, I told you, I think, last night, the Hubble telescope, it's looked to the furthest reaches of this Milky Way galaxy and hasn't seen any devas up in space. So where the heck does this smoke go? It doesn't even reach outer space. There's no one up there to receive it. So don't think burning houses is going to make your mother and father get a house in heaven. If they do get a house, it'll just be a paper house about this size. So instead, if your parents are going to die, use that money to make some good karma. And then share the merits. That does work. Do something useful rather than waste it on burning stupid paper. That's the Buddhist way. Ajahn, this is a meditation question at last. How to move into one pointedness in breath meditation? After my mind settles at silent present moment for a while, there are breath and sound awareness. How to drop the sound? How to drop the sound is you don't drop the sound. If you think the sound is a problem, then it will always stay. Whatever you pay attention to, whatever's important to you, either positive, this is very nice, or it's a problem, you will focus on. So somehow you have to ignore it, and then it goes away. It's the same way that if somebody knocks at the door of your house trying to sell you something, you say, go away. They don't go away, they knock again. But if you ignore them, and they think there's no one at home, then they go away. So don't encourage the sound. In other words, you don't call it a problem at all. It's just sound doing its thing, and you just watch the breath. Technically what that means, this is the nice simile about focusing. It's called the simile of the TV set, because these are similes which will relate to your normal life. When you first look at the TV set, when it's not turned on, you see the whole set and also the screen, which defines its size. But once the movie or the TV show or the football match is started, you find you can't even see the edges of the screen. The edges have disappeared because you focus inside. You become one-pointed. And all the irrelevant stuff on the edge or beyond the edge of the TV screen, you can't see. Which is why when you travel on these airlines and you've got these tiny screens on the back, the next time you go, have a look at the movie on that screen or some documentary, and you'll find it doesn't matter how big or small the screen is, it's exactly the same. The experience of the movie on a small screen in the back of an aircraft, on these huge screens in the movie theater, or on your sort of plasma screen TV, 4 foot wide or whatever it is, it's exactly the same. It's only when the screen isn't turned on, only then do you realize how small or big it is. Because it's the nature of focusing. The mind fits into the space available. I said that some years ago. And this person, they said, wow, that's amazing. We were about to buy this big plasma screen TV because we only got a small TV. And now we realize what a waste of money that is. So they're going to give the difference, I think, to the nuns' monastery. It's a wonderful way of getting some funds for the nuns' monastery. So if you've got a big TV or you're about to buy one, don't get a small TV and give the difference to the Dharmasala, building a big meditation hall there. Because you don't need it. It's just to impress everybody else. Try it the next time. Compare the experience when you're watching a movie on a small screen to the experience on a big screen. There's no difference once you're in the movie. Now, number two, what that means, you're watching the breath and the sound. The sound's over the edge of the screen, you're just watching the breath. And after a while, you don't concern with the breath. You don't concern with the sound. You are concerned with the breath. The sound is just the sound. The only thing which is important is the breath. The sound can do whatever it wants. The breath is the most important. And if you really value the breath and it's really important, it gets into the center of your screen and everything else falls off. And that's what happens. Sometimes you're watching your breath, you can feel the legs, you can feel the sound. It's hot or it's cold. Yeah, at the beginning. But you're focusing on the breath going in and out. You don't know when this happens, but you realize, hey, there's no sound. Hey, I can't feel my body. It disappears. In the same way, you don't know that moment when the edge of the screen disappears, but it does. And everything beyond the screen vanishes too. You don't know that moment just when all you've got left is the breath. And all those other things on the edge disappear. But that's what happens. And soon all you've got is the breath. No sound, no body, just the breath going in, going out. And everything else beyond the screen, even the edge of the screen, has all vanished. You're one-pointed. That's how it works. You try and make it happen, it doesn't work. So what you do is just value the breath more than anything else. This is the most important. Make it interesting and joyful. Just like watching a movie is more important than anything else. Then everything else vanishes. So you don't achieve this by negativity, by worrying and trying to get rid of all the distractions. You just make the object you're watching, the breath, more important. That's how it works. Now, the next question. What is the difference between the practice of the Putuchana and the Aryan, and why should they differ? The Putuchana is just the ordinary riffraff, and the Aryan is the enlightened ones. The ones who are streamliners, or once returners, or non-returners, or arahats. And one of the main differences, actually what's what Putuchana means, just the ordinary people. That's why I called it riffraff. It's a bit mean, but I hope you don't mind. But one of the great sayings in the suttas is, what the riffraff call happiness, the Aryans call suffering. And what the Aryans call happiness, it's the other way around. What the Aryans call happiness, the riffraff call suffering. What the Aryans call suffering, the riffraff call happiness. So you get it the wrong way around. That's a problem with you guys. So, falling in love. Oh, it's such happy. All the world loves a lover. The riffraff do. All the Aryans think, stupid, what are you doing that for? It's just going to be more suffering. How many of you have been married twice? Come on, don't you learn the first time? Oh, this time is different though. This is the real thing. Yeah. Now that's what I mean, that's how Aryans practice much differently. And you go back home, and then you say, wow, what do you do for Easter? Especially like some of you Singapore Malaysians, you only get such a small amount of holiday. I said, where did you go for your holiday? You know, you went to Perth, oh, did you go to Margaret River and taste the wines or the chocolate? Did you go to the beach and do the swimming? Did you go and see these amazing things? No. I went to this forest and just sat hour after hour after hour after hour. No wine, just didn't even have any dinner in the evening. Say, what? You stupid, you wasted your holiday just doing that? You weren't even allowed to speak? And they would say, that's suffering. But if you understand Buddhism, you say, oh, what happiness, what bliss. People get it the wrong way around. That's why sometimes the Aryans are just totally misunderstood. What are you doing spending your life becoming an anagarika, becoming a monk? You could do so much in this world. You know, get a wife. You know, have kids. You know, are you afraid of relationships, you guys? That's what they said to me. I'm not afraid of relationships. I sussed them out a long time ago. The best relationship is a relationship with peace. So that's the difference. So the Aryans, they realize simplicity. Few things are much better than many things. I went to Hong Kong, 2 months ago now, And I saw many Australians were in Hong Kong. What are you doing in Hong Kong? They're going shopping. And I saw many people from Hong Kong here in Perth. What are you doing? We're going shopping. Isn't there something wrong there somewhere? Haven't you got shops in Hong Kong? You Hong Kongers, haven't you got shops in Perth? I don't know. It's crazy. But the Aryans thinking, just why are you going shopping? What more do you need? How many pairs of shoes do you have to have? You only got two feet. Just one shoe for each foot is more than enough. How many dresses do you need? Okay, and then if you're, you know, your 20s and you're looking for a partner, okay, fair enough, get a few dresses. But, you know, most of you are past it. You don't need all these dresses. You're not going to attract anybody anymore, so. So forget about it. Just wear a daggy old clothes, that's good enough. And just, you know, they're much more comfortable. And that, it's much worse being women than men as far as clothes are concerned, because the sort of clothes you have to wear are really uncomfortable. You know, the high heels, I don't know how you manage that. There must be torture. And the worst thing, I remember once in Melbourne, they had this fashion that, I forget what it was, what they called it, but the girls always had to show their midriff. You know, skirts or trousers were just really low, and that top part wasn't really a shirt, it just, you know, was up past the belly button. Now that might be okay in Singapore, but in Melbourne in the winter, and I saw these poor girls, they were going blue around their midriff, and I really felt so much compassion for them. What you girls have to do to get a partner is just not, it's not worth it. Become a nun. Be much more sensible. So that's the lay people and the Aryans. The Aryans, no, these are the sort of people who become Aryans, you know, nice and warm. So that's actually how they differ. No need for fashion anymore. Anyway, here we go. It's really hard to concentrate longer time in present moment. Mind is very much going here and there. Is there any formula can apply for stopping the mind to go around? Thanks, and please describe the walking meditation. Okay. Now, it's not about concentration. Those of you who've listened to me a long time know that that word rings a red flag and it rings an alarm bell for me. This is not about concentration. That was one of the worst translations done when the English people first tried to find a word for samadhi and meditation. Unfortunately, it stuck. We always think this is about concentration. It's not about concentration. It's about stillness. Concentration makes you tense. When I was at school, the teacher would stand over me and say, "Concentrate!" And it's something you had to do by will. And worse than that, concentration camps. What is that? Now this is samadhi camp. So if you try concentration, this becomes a concentration camp. And you all know what happened in those concentration camps. And some retreats are like concentration camps. Believe me, your bell goes in the morning. If you don't get up, you're in big trouble. So this is not concentration. Concentration is a wrong word. It brings too much negativity, too much force. And you never get what meditation is all about. Stillness. So if it's hard to concentrate, remember it is because you have been doing second noble truth meditation. You're wanting something. That's why it's difficult. You stop wanting something. Be content with what you've got. How easy is that? Don't try to concentrate. Don't try to do anything. Whatever you're experiencing right now, just be happy with it. Be content with it. This is good enough. Let go of craving. Any craving. Just be here. And if you can just do that much, meditation is the easiest thing in the whole world. And also, it gets incredibly profound and deep. And now you know how to meditate. You can meditate having a beautiful, peaceful time. Why? Because you're not trying to get things. Even in the first teaching of the Buddha,
The Buddha describes suffering. Suffering is a separation from what you want. Is suffering. So I want something. The reason I want it is because I haven't got it. I'm separated from what I want. That very thing is the essence of suffering. Whatever it is you want, which you haven't got now, that's called suffering. If you have a restless mind and you don't want a restless mind, that is suffering. The restless mind isn't suffering. It's not wanting it. That's the suffering. So, give up all wanting. And when you give up all wanting, I'm restless. Restlessness, take me. I'm tired. Tiredness. I love you, tiredness. Sloth and torpor, you're such a wonderful thing to know. And then when you don't fight these things, you find the restlessness disappears. The sloth and torpor vanishes. You become really peaceful. Why? Because you're not doing anything. You're not shaking up the lake anymore. You're not wasting your energy fighting these battles, which is what sloth and torpor come from. So just let go. How many times have you heard, let go, let go, let go, let go, let go? When you actually get the message, meditation's so easy. Some of you get the message and have these beautiful meditations. When you do have the beautiful meditation, why was this one so beautiful and so easy? Because you didn't do anything. You weren't struggling. You didn't even try to concentrate. Now, she's not here on this retreat, but this one girl. I remember one of the retreats at Khao Lak. And we just finished, and I was just, we finished in the morning, and you know, I was going to have my lunch, and I just started my lunch, and this girl came up to me, just now, almost crying, sneering on the door. Oh, Ajahn Brahm, at last. Oh, it's so wonderful. Oh, it's so beautiful. This is when you first get your meditation. It's like, the nearest simile is like, you know, when you fall in love. Oh, Mum, Dad, I'm in love. I've met this guy. He's so wonderful. Oh, just similar, just the emotional high of getting your first meditation experience. And I said, what happened? And she said, well, she'd been meditating for 9 days, getting absolutely nowhere, totally frustrated. And so, you know, it was an hour before lunch, and then afterwards she was going to go and get the bus back to the airport. So she had nothing to do. So, you know, we'd all left and people were packing up. She decided to stay in the meditation hall and meditate. She was just killing time. She did, you know, she 9 days, she got nowhere. So she said, oh, I've got nothing else to do, just kill time. And that's where she got a nice meditation, because she wasn't trying anymore. She'd totally given up hope. So you give up hope. You know, you are hopeless. How many times have you tried meditating? You know, some of you. I've known you for a long time. You are totally hopeless. So give up. And then you get some nice meditation. That's how it works. So please, don't try hard to concentrate. And then it's very easy. Walking meditation I'll talk about tomorrow. Next question. I am a gay Indo and my parents are Muslim. The Quran says we are evil. My parents are ashamed of me. How can I find happiness? Become a Buddhist. Because as a Buddhist then you are totally accepted. You are received as an equal amongst all other people. We don't discriminate at all. One of the problems is that some of these books were written a long time ago. And again, the information wasn't really there, and people were scared of minorities like gay people. Fortunately, the Buddhism, yeah, we have our books, but instead of making pronouncements like that, they just pronounce principles. And one of the great principles in Buddhism, we just chanted, may all beings be happy and well, whatever beings they may be, whether they are great or small. Whether they are gay or straight, maybe we should include that word in there because that's implied very, very strong. May all beings be happy and well. I remember the Singapore girl, she wrote me the letter, you know, she found out her son was gay. She said, what should I do? This was many years ago. And I said, look, didn't the Buddha say, may all beings be happy and well? And aren't you supposed to love all beings? Your son is a being, for goodness sake, love him. So she said, that's a good point. So, if you are a gay Indo, congratulations. Just be a good gay Indo. And you can become a Buddhist. And in Indonesia, you know, you're allowed to sort of choose. In Malaysia, it's much more difficult. But in Indonesia, because I'm really famous over there because of my books, I think I've been telling people, I've created a traffic jam in Indonesia, 2 kilometres around the venue in Medan where I gave my talk. So that meant... And I outsold Lady Gaga. I sold that, told that last night. Her tickets took 2 days to sell. My tickets sold in 8 hours for 3,500 people. But many Muslims come to my talks in Indonesia. Many Muslims say they're Buddhists. So you can do that. So, well, as far as your parents are concerned, you can... maybe tell them, look, this is who I am. Doesn't sort of, you know, the religion come from the heart rather than from a book? And, you know, if it's a problem, you have to... Well, I don't like the idea, you have to keep it quiet, because that's... How can you keep it quiet from your parents? These are your parents, the people you love. You should be able to share your life with the people you love and respect. So I don't think there's too much of a problem. But if you're a Buddhist, there's no problem at all. You're totally accepted. Recently, which is one of the things, I gave... My goodness, got lots of time. I don't care. I'm not finishing. Just before I went to Indonesia, I gave a talk on gay marriage. Because it was a hot issue in London, and it's a hot issue here in Australia. So I put my submission in to the government, totally supporting gay marriage. And I passed it around to a few people. Unfortunately... This government in Australia has this rule: if you put a submission in for this official government inquiry about finding out what religious leaders think about gay marriage, you're not allowed to publish it anywhere else. So I can't put it in any newsletter or anything right now, but you know my views on this. And these are classic Buddhist views. I pass it around, everybody agrees it. No problem at all. You are welcome. Please, you know, have a gay marriage. But since putting it around, Ajahn Sujata is really good. He really does some good research. He actually looked at Karen Armstrong's books. You know, Karen Armstrong, a very good bestseller. She's written about Buddhism and other religions. She was an ex-Catholic nun. And she'd done this book, I think, on the Gospel According to Women or something. And in it, she looks at marriage. She said for over 1,000 years, especially Christianity, had nothing to do with marriage. Regarded it as a pagan ritual, and only in the Renaissance era did it even recognize marriage. And now it decides to control marriage. So it was never originally part of religion, marriage. The same as Buddhism. We recognize marriage in Buddhism, but it was there before Buddhism. So this whole idea of religion trying to stop gay people getting married is ridiculous. It's an historical anomaly. Religion never had anything to do with marriage. It's only very recently, since the Renaissance, apparently, according to Karen Armstrong, who usually knows her stuff pretty well, only since the Renaissance, which was about, 300, 400 years ago, did religion even get involved with marriage at all. And of course now, a lot of people have to get married in the religious ceremony. And there, once it becomes a religious ceremony, gays can't get married. But that's totally an anomaly. So, as far as Buddhists are concerned, yep, if you're a couple of gays, I'll marry you. Yeah, I want to do that. I've already ordained bhikkhunis, that's my next goal. So yeah, I mean, you're supported, you're welcome. Ever since I was a little boy, I've been helpful. My parents demanded this. I have lived my life in fear of not doing what people ask. As a Buddhist, I try to make every interaction good. If I don't, feel bad. I have trouble sleeping and I can't stop thinking. I feel very uptight and pressured. If you try to be good, you end up being bad. So you can't do that. If you're trying so hard, you get really frustrated, and after a while you get uptight and you do wrong things because you are uptight. You can't be good if you're tense. If you're relaxed, it's easy to be good. If you're relaxed, it's easy to be kind. I think I mentioned this in a talk in Singapore recently. One of the reasons why people have negative emotions is because they're tired and stressed. If people would only relax more, we wouldn't get so upset at people. That's all it is. You know what it's like. You've been busy at work, and you come home in the traffic, and then your partner just says one thing, you explode. If you've been in Jhana Grove retreat for 9 days, and you go back to Singapore or whatever, and your partner says, does exactly the same thing, oh, never mind, it's okay, let it go. I'm not going to allow anyone to control my happiness. It's just in one ear, out the other. You can say whatever you like, because you relax. So that's an extreme, but you know what it's like. If you're tense, you're tired, stressed out, it's so easy to get negative emotions. So if you're uptight trying to be helpful, you'll have negativity sooner or later. So instead, learn how to relax. And don't worry what other people think about you or what they ask. Some people ask me all sorts of things, you know, because I'm a monk, can you come here, can you come here? And so what I do, you have to be diplomatic. So I usually say, well, I'll think about it. And I do, I think about it. I think, no way I'm going there. I'm thinking about it, I'm not lying. My other trick, I shouldn't tell you all these tricks, I say, I'll ask the Sangha. Because, you know, I'm a monk and what I do affects all these others. So a lot of time I'll say, well, you know, I'm not sure if I can teach that extra retreat. I'll ask the Sangha. So I asked the Sangha, I said, please say no, I'm really sorry. And they say, okay, yes, okay. I say, well, I couldn't do anything. The Sangha is just, you know, it's not my decision, it's all this monk. So there's lots of ways you can get, you know, around these things. If it's a committee thing, you know, like, should we, you know, a committee, what's a good committee thing? Should we start a Buddhist school? And they say, oh, we better sort of get a subcommittee to investigate. We've got lots of subcommittees in our Buddhist society which have never done anything. They were established just to pass the buck to somebody who will never get anything done, so we wouldn't have to do anything in the first place. So that's another thing, in a Buddhist fellowship, get a subcommittee to investigate it. So that way, people ask you these things, you don't have to say no. That's the trouble. If they ask, you know, can you come and do sort of another retreat at Singapore? If I say no, I'm in big trouble. So why not? Because you're supposed to be compassionate. And they got all these arguments. And they argue, and they beat me down after a while. So that's where I end up doing all these stupid things. But my usual trick is I have to ask the Sangha, or, you know, it's I'll think about it. You know, just people forget, because I'm still thinking. So, you know, people ask you these things, and just say, I'll think about it. And then you don't have to do it, and you have a nice time. Some people have a good perception of me, and some don't. I have many perceptions of myself. What is the real me? None of those. So sometimes you'll be the good guy, sometimes you can be the bad guy. You know, that's really useful, because in the police, they always have the good guy and the bad guy routine. So, you know, sometimes it's nice to be the bad guy. You know, we did that once. You know, this is a story from Ajahn Jacko's time, when he was the abbot here. You know that gate to Bodhinyana Monastery? The gate, we got these wrought iron people to make that gate for us, and we designed it. And Ajahn Jacko, we were going up to see him, he said, look, I'm really in big trouble. They're not doing the job I wanted to do. And I've already been kind to him. So Ajahn Bhavan, can you be the bad guy? And I'll be the good guy. And it was really good fun, because I don't get much chance to be the bad guy. So I really got into it. I went over there and said, this is not what we asked for. You've got to do it the other way. And they said, well, Kostama, no, it's not. This was the quote. You have to do it this way. And the driver said, you did such a good job, Ajahn Bhavan, because he heard the people making this. He said, we don't want to see this guy anymore. The other guy, that monk can come, but not that guy. Please never bring him back again. I really enjoyed that, being a bad guy, just, you know, to get, you know, the work properly done. So if you can be the bad guy sometimes, yeah, you can really get a lot of... I can use you. In other words, you're not a good guy or a bad guy. That's perceptions. Depends what you look at. Is the wall with two bad bricks, is that a beautiful wall or an ugly wall? It depends if you look at the bricks or if you look at the good bricks or the bad bricks. The same as that old conundrum, the grass half... only got half up to the, only the water only up to halfway. Is it half full or half empty? And the answer is, my glass is half empty if I want more tea to drink.
It's half full if I've had enough. Depends on your perception of what you want. Respecting and respectable Ajahn. Please give the principle and technique in walking meditation. That's number two. If you get another one, I'll tell you. How is it possible that there is a permanent change when streamlining happens that cannot be reversible? Oh, it's just when the flame goes out, it's just done. Some changes are irreversible. No, just like, you know, me becoming spiritual, was it patron of the Buddhist Fellowship? Is that reversible, Angie? It is reversible. No, he's just saying yes. Okay. Sometimes I get into these things and I can't get out of them. So, yeah, some things are reversible and some things are not. And one of the things which isn't reversible is permanent is when you say something. As soon as it's out of your mouth, you're in big trouble. That's why there's an old story. Here we go, another old story. About, because people often ask me about Buddhist ceremonies and their meaning. There's one Buddhist ceremony which is actually quite useful. It's called the chicken ceremony. I don't know if you know that chicken ceremony ritual in Buddhism. Where it comes from, a good example of its use, is that once this guy came to the temple late in the evening. The reason he came to the temple because he'd been thrown out of the house by his wife for saying some really rotten things to his partner. You know what it's like sometimes. Some of the things you say to the people you love are disgusting. And he said something, you know, he was really upset, tense, stressed out. And he said something to his wife. And his wife threw him out. So he went to the temple. And the monks, you know, said, okay, you can sleep here tonight, but if you want, and they said, how can I overcome this? And he said, the only way to overcome, you know, this is the chicken ceremony. And he said, what's a chicken ceremony? He said, well, first of all, you need a chicken. You know, obviously, for the chicken ceremony, you've got to get a chicken. So he said, look, there's still time. Let's go to the 7-Eleven or the market and get a chicken. You know, not sort of, you know, one who's just been killed. It has to be fresh. And on the way back from the market, you know, to the monastery, pluck the chicken on the way. Because when it gets here, I want it to be like a freshly plucked chicken. Not from a freezer, has to be sort of a warm one. So he ran to the market, managed to get one of the chickens from the store. And on the way back, plucked it, took all the feathers out, threw them away. So when he got to the temple, the chicken was freshly plucked and still warm. Said, right, said the monk, I'll put this in the refrigerator overnight. You go and take a rest, and we'll do the second part of the chicken ceremony tomorrow morning. So he had a good rest, and the following morning he woke up, and the monk took the chicken out of the freezer. He sort of thawed it in the microwave, and he said, right, here's the chicken, just as it was last night, and I want you to retrace your steps back to the market, collect all the feathers which you threw away yesterday, and put them back in the chicken where they came from. He said, I can't even find the feathers, let alone put them back in where they came from. He said, now that's a chicken ceremony. So, yes, you get it. As soon as it, can you put that back in your mouth? Of course you can. As soon as it comes out, it's out, and you can't catch it. You don't even know where it's gone. All those words you say, once it's out, you can't even collect them. You don't know where they've gone, let alone put them back in your mouth again. So the point of that story is, once it's out of your mouth, it's out and you're in big trouble. So the only thing to do is be careful the way you speak. Because once it's out, it cannot be retraced again. You cannot put it back in again. That's why some of these things are permanent. You can't catch the words and put them back in. I am a young man who is being pressured by my parents. In 5 years, they expect me to be married, and at 30, I have to have kids. Are you in big trouble? I find it very hard to meet girls. Can you give me some advice on how to get a girl? Oh, come on. Hang on. This is a young man, so have a look. Which young man must this be? There's only a few young No, he won't embarrass anybody. Number one, being pressured by your parents. Look, you don't. The best way to get out of this is to become a monk. Then they can't pressure you anymore. And you don't have to get married and have kids. So that's the best way out. You know, ordain. Then you're free.
And I tell, seriously, you can tell parents, if you want to become a monk and your parents stop you, it really is serious, that's very, very bad karma for your parents. You tell them, I said that, they respect me. That is stopping a person doing a wonderful, kind, good, you know, wholesome act. Preventing them from doing a wholesome act is very bad karma. So if your parents don't want you to become a monk, they're in big trouble. So that's the best way of avoiding it, because if you don't, society expects you to find good. And if you know, you can't find a girl, the girl will find you. You're in big trouble after a while. So... And you know what it's like? You know, they're very nice and soft before you get married. We used to see this in northeast Thailand. These were very poor villages, remember? And so we always knew when the girl came to, like, you know, the time they were looking for a partner, they were wearing the really nice dresses. And you knew the day they got married, because the day after they got married, they were wearing the rags again. Because the nice dresses they passed on to their younger sister, so she could attract a boy. What's the use, you know, of the pollen, you know, to attract the bee once the bee's already been there? So in other words, all the nice dresses and the scents and the jewelry, you know, once you caught your partner, the boy, then it went to the next person. And it was just so obvious, you know, just what you were doing. So if you really think of marrying a beautiful girl, have a look what happens to beautiful girls after 30 or 40 years. Have a look around. All the people. These were once really beautiful women, which would make boys, you know, say stupid things and make them get all excited and flutter. Now look at them. Is that where you want to end up? Okay, go on. Am I in trouble? Men marrying. It's just because men marrying women is allowed, and men marrying men isn't allowed. That's why I'm supportive of it. Basically, of course, you know, it's consistent about breaking down stupid barriers. So if they want to, they should be able to. It's not recommended. Much better. But you know, at least they should have the feet. No one should say no to them. Dissuade it, okay. So anyway, if that's you, look, you don't have to get married in today's world. You are, before, if you didn't get married, people will think there's something wrong with you. In today's world, you can be single and be respected. There's a lot of women, a lot of men like that. They stay single and they're respected for that. So anyway, don't be pressured by your parents. Somehow the food here tastes better than any 5-star restaurant. I ate more here than usual. Best of all, I have nothing to do in here. Enjoy every minute of it. It's great, yeah. So it is better than a 5-star restaurant. And the reason it tastes more delicious here is because you've got no stress. You're not talking to each other. Imagine, you can't be talking and paying attention to the person who's talking to you and be paying attention to the food at the same time. You get distracted. But when no one is talking to you, all your senses can actually concentrate and focus on the taste of the food. You can really enjoy it. Which is the reason why, if ever you, when you leave here, you go out to a nice restaurant, especially an expensive restaurant, you know, with your partner, the only way to get your money's worth, so you can really fully taste this food, you know, which these great chefs are preparing, is tell your partner, shut up. Because I paid a lot of money for this food, and if you're talking to me, I can't really get my money's worth, I can't enjoy it. So, okay, we go to this fine restaurant, you shut up, when I've finished eating, then you can talk. That's why it's more delicious here, because you pay more attention to things, and your senses are opening up. That's why it's more delicious. It's not the cooks. I'm sorry, Bianca, at the back. She's a good cook, but it's the mindfulness increases, and you've got more time to enjoy. You're more relaxed, and everything gets more enjoyable. Even it's, you know, my stupid jokes get, you know, people laugh more on retreats because, you know, they're more sensitive, they can appreciate their profundity. They're not so tensed up. Anyway, I try to follow your advice and watch the breath anywhere in the body, but I notice that if I focus on my belly, my mind is more concentrated. Bad word. Still remember, not concentrated. Because the mind is not jumping from one place to another, is it dependent upon individual? Where is the best for them to focus? Also, this focus on the perception of the breath thing is very subtle. When I try it, I don't know where the toast is, where the touch is it in my mind. Is it better to watch the coarse aspects of the breath first and focus on the subtle aspect of the breath? Thank you very much. Your books are of great help to me. If they are, then read the book. It's all in there. But nevertheless, if just let the breath go to where the breath wants to go. Remember, it's not focusing in the sense of concentrating in one point in space. Look at it as focusing one point in time. The present moment. So keep the present moment. Focus on the present moment. So there's just this moment, not the past, not the future. If you do that, it's much easier to find stillness. If you're trying to focus on one point in space, sometimes that creates too much tension in the mind. So focus on one pointedness in time, rather one pointedness in space. This is an interesting question. Can gay mud wrestling lead to freedom? We get some weird questions. And the answer is no. So don't try it on this retreat. Now there's some mud around the back of the teacher's cottage. When I meditated for about 2 hours, I felt so peaceful and happy. Excellent. I felt the importance of letting go when I released everything. My mind was very light. I felt quite happy, but suddenly in my body, I felt like fire started burning. My heart started beating so fast, as if it were coming out. I felt great difficulty and fear. I felt something was going on, going out from the body with burning sensation. I really got afraid and started crying. Ah. After that, I feel afraid to be so peaceful and happy because I feel it might happen again. I'd love meditation, but I'm afraid to meditate longer. How can this overcome this fear? If you start to feel burning, we've got these fire extinguishers outside. So just sit next to one. And if your heart is coming out of the body, great. Isn't that the title of my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart? It's working at last. Now look, seriously, what's happening is you're getting nice and peaceful, you're letting go, and your mind's very light, but then you lost that focus of the mind and you went on to your body. Let the body vanish. Don't even be concerned about the body. But stay with that feeling of peace, especially the beautiful, subtle breath and the happy breath, until the body's totally vanished. You don't know what's going on with the body. But if in that state you've got lots of energy and you start to get awareness of the body, it's like that energy goes into the body. It should be staying in the mind. And it's I call it the leaky bucket. And the water's supposed to be in the bucket, not dripping out. You've got the mind. Allow the energy to stay in the mind. It's peaceful, it's energized, it's wonderful. You see these great nimittas if you stay with the mind. But if you start worrying about what the body's doing, then it disturbs the body. And you get all sorts of weird experiences. It's not dangerous at all. Nothing's going out. There's no fire happening there. It's just a bit of sort of distraction. It might be unpleasant, but it soon disappears. But the best thing to do is just to stay in the mind and let the body go. Don't be concerned with the body. It's a leaky bucket problem. So plug up the hole so you don't go back to the body, you just stay with the mind. Then you have wonderful meditations. But it's never dangerous. I've been teaching meditation for I don't know how many years. I have had no casualties yet. So you're perfectly safe. Dear Ajahn Brahm, in my meditation I keep control of my mind to be present, to make peace, to be kind. It's not control. It's letting go. To do everything you teach and I get a massive headache. Exactly. So much that I can't see well at night and it's affecting my digestion. How can I stop controlling my own mind in my meditation? Number one, let go of past and future. Do it stage by stage. When there's no past and no future for you, it's very hard to control anything. Because all control is about, you know, what you're going to do next. right in this moment. It's already here. How can you control this present moment? It's just here. It's beyond you. You control the future. At least you think you can. Right, I'm really going to get my meditation. I'm going to focus. I must let go. I must be kind. I must be gentle. That's future stuff. Be kind now. Even think like opening the door of your heart to the present moment. Because loving kindness is not just loving people you like. It's loving everything, even the unpleasant. That's what opening the door of your heart means. Unconditional awareness of the present moment. No matter what it is, I'm just going to be here with it. And be kind to it. That's how we let go. Trying to be in the present, it does give you a headache. So because you're trying, it's second noble truth meditation. Now look, you might be struggling with this all during this retreat, but if you understand that one point, what letting go really means, and you have just a few moments of third noble truth meditation, the whole retreat is worth it. Because you're getting some insight into what meditation is, what the Buddha was on about, and why this leads to enlightenment. For many people, it's a hard thing even to fathom. Letting go, doing nothing, just being still, letting go of time, disappearing. But little by little, you get it. And once you get it, you go, oh, now that's how you meditate. That's why all these monks and nuns are having a good time. Just to get that one point is worth just so many hundreds of retreats. So eventually you'll get it. But if you're getting a headache, it's the wrong type of meditation. So go back to the basics, present moment awareness. Just do that first of all. By nature, I'm a person who doesn't hurt anybody's feelings. When someone hurts me, it upsets me a lot. I try to remember your advice. Have no expectations, but it's hard. Can you recommend an antidote? When somebody hurts me, it upsets me a lot. Imagine yourself like a lotus flower. People can urinate on a lotus. They can shit on a lotus. But it just runs off the lotus leaf and it leaves no residue. The lotus is always fragrant, no matter what people throw on it. So you be like the lotus. People call you an idiot. They call you a fool. They call you stupid and even worse. There's a limit to my vocabulary as a monk because I'm very sensitive. But I'm not always sensitive. If somebody says what to me was the very worst, what's it called, like not slander, criticism, but the very worst curse. If someone says to you, the worst curse I've ever heard was, and this was from the Middle East, which are really good at cursing. The worst curse in the Middle East is, may the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. That's got some class to it. That's why I remembered it. So if you really want to upset somebody in a sort of a really classy way, like your boss at work, or you know, you go home and you know, you really don't like your wife. Wife, may the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. I thought it was very funny. She probably burst out laughing. It won't work. But anyway, if somebody tries to upset you, why are they doing that for? They're trying to make you upset. They're trying to hurt you. Why do you allow them to do that? Refuse. Refuse to get hurt. And then they'll stop trying to hurt you anymore because they realize you're someone who doesn't have their buttons pressed that easy. Metta bhavana to deal with anger. I'm mindful of this and eventually let go. But when it first happens, it's too hard. Not metta, but wisdom. Wisdom is the greatest antidote to anger. Metta, yes, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but wisdom is really powerful. Oh, as I said to someone the other day, this is from the Dalai Lama. Look, that person is really rude to you. They're really hard to live with. But it might be your boss. You only have to live with them for 40, 50 hours a week. But they have to live with themselves 24 hours a day for the rest of their life. So imagine a person like that. They're so rude and hurtful and cruel to you. But you don't have to be with them all the time. They have to be with themselves the rest of their life, poor things. It's a very good reflection. It means you have compassion for these people who are assholes.
I am sort of increasing my vocabulary. Did the Buddha teach that we have to perfect paramis for countless lifetimes before awakening or developing qualities? If so, how does this fit with the teaching that anyone can awaken except to kill parents, etc.? Exactly. This idea of paramis came way after the time of the Buddha. In fact, it was invented by Mahayana, who divided it to have six paramis which you have to develop. And as soon as Mahayana developed the six paramis, Theravada had to go one better, so we had 10 paramis, just so we can outdo the Mahayanas. And so, that's history, that's what happens. Some religions, it's always keeping up with the opposition, just like, you know, marketing. That's what it is, basically. So because of that, originally there was no such thing as paramis. And once they had, like, the 10 paramis in Theravada Buddhism, they had to get some justification for that, and so they invented the Dasa Jataka, the 10 Jataka tales, which came actually to justify the 10 paramis. And from those 10 Jataka tales, which are very common in Sri Lanka and Thailand, the very last Jataka, where the Buddha finished his last parami, which was dana, you know, generosity, that was the Vaisantara Jataka, you know, in Thai, Vaisandor. And that is supposed to be the last life of the Buddha, and it's a really crazy life because he gave away his kids to someone who beat the hell out of them, and even gave his wife away. And that was just, people say, that wasn't wise, that wasn't a good thing to do, that's actually child abuse. But we celebrate that the last life of the Buddha really gave away everything. He gave away his brain at the same time by the look of things. But I can say that because everybody who knows their Buddhism knows that that came a long time after the Buddha. Against that, in the early stream of Buddhism, in the suttas, this is the closest we can get to the reality of what actually happens. We have the Gatikara Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, which shows a previous life of the Buddha very close to his last life, if not the last life. And that's a great one to look at because the Gatikara Sutta, the Buddha was talking to Ananda and he said in a previous life, he said he was talked about this guy Gatikara who was a potter, who was a non-returner. The only reason he didn't become a monk was because his parents were blind. But interestingly, it's a great story of what it's like to be an enlightened being as a lay person. This person, he was a potter, but he wouldn't sell his pots. He would leave them on a bench outside his hut and say, anyone who wanted a pot, take one. If you want to leave some beans and some rice, leave some beans and rice to feed me. He wouldn't have anything to do with money. That's a sign of like a noble person, just barter. And he had a best friend called Jyotipala, who was a Brahmin. And Jyotipala, no, this Gatikara was a disciple of the previous Buddha, Kassapa. So there's not one Buddha, that makes a lot of sense. Many Buddhas, you know, one after the other. And Gatikara was a great disciple of the Buddha, Kassapa. And Jyotipala, his best friend, would never want to go and see Kassapa the Buddha. He called him like a bald-headed good-for-nothing. He's actually scolded him. And eventually this Gatikara managed to get his best friend to see Kassapa the Buddha. And as soon as he saw the Kassapa the Buddha, he got faith in Kassapa the Buddha and asked to become a monk. And he ordained under Kassapa the Buddha. And our Buddha Gautama said, that was me in a previous life. And a very recent previous life, because Kassapa is supposed to be this eon. So there we have a previous life of the Buddha, as we know it, who couldn't even recognize another Buddha and would say bad things about him. So, and that became our Buddha in a very short time. That really shows you about this parami business. Is very overblown. In this very recent life of Gautama the Buddha, he couldn't even recognize a Buddha when he saw one, and he was with a Buddha, and even said bad things about him. So that's real. So, you can say bad things about monks, bad things about me,
But you can still become a Buddha. You can become enlightened. So you don't need much to get deep meditation and to get enlightened. That's why everyone here can. Ajahn Brahm, my monkey mind seems to like to jump from one branch to another. It's difficult for this monkey mind to stay on one branch, let alone on nothing. Breath appears to be nothing to this monkey mind. Could you please give this monkey mind something to hold on to? Yes? Please. Whoever wrote that question, this is for you. Okay. Hold on to no desire. No wanting. That's a good one to hold on to. So just, if the mind wants to go off to another branch, off you go, mind. I'm not going to control you at all. So let the mind do what the mind wants to do. Let the body do what the body wants to do. Just don't control. Let go of the proper thing of controlling. And then the monkey will stop. In the same way, if you turn off the gas of the car, doesn't matter how hard you press down on the accelerator, the car comes to a stop. Because the source of the monkey mind, control, wanting, that has been turned off. Let go of desire. Let go of controlling. If the mind wants to go, if you go, fine with me. Then it stops. Okay, one of my other stories. Okay, there was my fifth range retreat as a monk. And I had this perfect monastery. It was absolutely great monastery in the north of Thailand. Cool, beautiful cave, great food. Lay people who didn't really want to do anything except feed me, and that's all. They left me alone. I was by myself in a beautiful, quiet place. It was perfect. After the first couple of weeks, my mind was pretty good. But after that, it really started going downhill fast. I started being so restless, and I couldn't stop my mind. It got worse and worse, and then it started thinking of what I call unmonkish thoughts. I started thinking about old girlfriends, sexual fantasies, even weird stuff. And I was a monk. I've always wanted to be a monk. I wasn't interested in that sort of stuff, but I couldn't stop it. And I was going more and more crazy with all these thoughts. And the worst thing was, there was no one there to talk to get some advice. I was only about 5 or 6 years as a monk. So there was a big Buddha statue, as there is in all Thai monasteries. I went there, bowed, and asked for help. And I got an idea. And my idea, which came to me, was do a deal. Have a compromise. And a compromise was, for all my waking day, I'd watch the breath, but 1 hour every afternoon from 3 to 4 would be my sexual fantasies, old girlfriends, romance, anything goes hour. And I let my mind do whatever it wants. I wouldn't stop it for that hour. The rest of the time it had to behave. Because I thought, if you have to think of those things, you know, then give it an hour. Okay, think whatever you want. The rest of the time behave. That was my plan. But it never worked as I expected it. I was still fighting my mind. I'd start watching the breath. Come on, watch the breath. Breath in. And these thoughts would just come in. And I couldn't stop them. And I'd try and keep them out again. It was a battle all day. And I wasn't having much success. So it came to 3 o'clock. I went up to my room, leaned against the wall, and said, okay, anything goes. You can think about any sexual fantasy, any girlfriend, any romantic idea. Whatever you want, you can do. And for the next hour, I watched every breath without missing one. And it was so easy. It was weird. But that really changed me. The way I realized what letting go was. All those thoughts and fantasies, they were coming up because I was trying to stop them. I was actually feeding them. I was controlling. And that's what made them worse. That's why they were getting worse and worse. Because I reacted to trying to stop and block these thoughts. Come back to the breath. You're a monk. You shouldn't do these things. Because of that degree of control, it got worse and worse and worse. And I said, okay, let go, do whatever you want. Then it got peaceful. Then it got still, because I let it go. The very cause for all those thoughts and fantasies was just let go of. Now that is how you stop the monkey mind. Be content with whatever you've got. This is good enough. Then the mind stops moving. Experiment with that, it really works.
Okay, maybe last question. It's 9:20. It's getting a bit late. Can you give instruction for processing grief, the death of a parent or child that causes much pain? Efforts have been made to let go, but a deeper sorrow still remains. Okay, it's just conditioning, because we are conditioned by a grief culture. I remember doing a small 2-week retreat, and during that 2-week retreat, many years ago, Princess Diana died. And when I came off retreat, and it was the biggest news in the whole world. And many people didn't even know Princess Diana. And even people didn't even sort of support monarchies. They were Republicans, but still, oh, it's so sad. And everybody was crying. And it was just a media beat up. It was like just, you know, grief. Because, you know, sometimes people like to grieve. That's why, don't you like to go to these movies? The tearjerkers. You know you're going to cry. You actually go into the movie theatre with the tissues already. And why do you do that for? Oh, because it's nice to cry. Crazy people. So, instead of conditioning our cultures with grief and celebrating grief. Now, my mother died recently, and you know, because she was a Christian, and my brother's a sort of nominal Christian, not real Christian. If I ever argued with him, sort of, you know, he'd probably turn it all upside down. But anyway, so they had a Christian priest, and it was just so morbid. Oh, it's so sad that your mother, Mrs. Betts, left 2 sad children. I'm not sad. Stop making assumptions of, you know, what I am. I'm very happy my mother is now free of that nursing home. And you know, the people who are really sad were the people who didn't know her. It's just all conditioning, because that's what you're supposed to do when you're sad. I've gone to many Christian funeral services here in Perth, and they're just so morbid. You know, even if you never knew the person who died, you know, you'd start crying. Because they play all this music, like, you know, apparently it's a theme to the Titanic or something. Our love will go on. And, you know, the Titanic, a big ship sunk, you know, and lots of people go. Yeah, of course that's going to make people sad and grieve. That is why 2 of my disciples here, and I hope the rest of you do this as well, at their funerals, they don't play the theme song from the Titanic. They play the last song from The Life of Brian. Look on the bright side of life. Now that's what a funeral should be. You know, that's Dhamma. Look on the bright side of life. That's very apt, because, you know, that song was when Brian was being crucified. You know, today is his execution day, so it's very, you know, otherwise known. I call it execution day, but it's really like Good Friday, they say. I don't know why they call it Good Friday when their leader got executed. That's a really weird way of saying something good. So that's why I prefer to call it execution day. But that's the life of Brian. And so, you know, they're being up on the cross there, you know, look at the bright side of life. It's a great song. It just shows you just that. That's more like Dhamma, more Buddhist, because that shows no matter what's happened to you, you can always look on the bright side and just dance. So anyway, processing grief, the death of a parent or a child that causes much pain. You all know the story of the concert, which I did. You know, that's, you know, which I figured out when my father died. Life is like a concert. When the concert ends, that's called death. How many of you cry at the end of a concert? How many of you feel grief? Now the music's over. You never feel grief at the end of a great performance. You feel in a sense of being blessed, being so privileged, so lucky to have been there at the time. Got these great performances. Now that's the alternative, to think that at the end of a life, what a wonderful time you had with your child. I would have missed that for the world. Would you rather that child never came into your life? Would you rather that parent, you know, never existed for you, you were an orphan? You had a parent, had a wonderful time. Celebrate the time you had, like a great concert. Where does this grief come from? Totally conditioned from the negative religions of our world. We don't have negative religion in Buddhism. So you hang around this place a lot, and you find that when people die, you don't feel grief. We recondition you. Re-brainwash you. But, like all concerts must come to an end, so do this evening's questions and answers come to an end. Are you sad? Are you going to cry on your way out here? Oh, the question and answer's finished. It's all over. It's dead.
Or are you going to think, wow, at last, I really want to go to the toilet. I really want to go. He's gone on for such a long time. Just like that's what I thought with my mother. She's gone on for too long. My mother's life, because the last 2 or 3 years was in Alzheimer's. She went on for too long. Just like this talk can go on for too long. There's a time when it ends and it's beautiful to end. So don't go on for too long. Ever in life. Okay. So there we go. Those are some of the questions and some of the answers. Some flippant answers, because I've got a lot of flippant questions, like this dummy thing. And what was the other one about? Gay mud wrestling. That was a classic. But some important questions as well. So hopefully the important ones, you get the message, and the light-hearted ones will remind you this meditation is light-hearted. If you're heavy, how can you become enlightened? So keep it light, keep it easy and gentle, and that's the fastest way to enlightenment. The Buddha said, this is a path without groaning. Beautiful quote. Without groaning, without, this hurts, not working. If you're groaning, it's not the right path. So recalibrate your direction. Okay, so good night everybody, have a nice sleep, pleasant dreams, see you in the morning. Remember, when you get up, what should you do? Zibbity zoodah with God. But not too loud, please. Okay. Sadhu. 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 Good night.